This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're in the studios of the Library of Congress with one of America's most admired, valued, and loved poets, Carolyn Forché, who's going to talk to us right now.
Thank you, Grace. Thank you for having me. I'll just open with a little statement I wrote about poetry. What draws me to poetry is mystery, sensibility, and the hidden architecture of the poem, excavated in its making and revealed in the tremor of its wakefulness. When I'm truly writing, the poem takes me as close as possible to the precipice and allows me to see, however obliquely, what the other has seen. Only the poem knows the route, tacking between temporal latitudes until the armada of the impeding thoughts have been blown off course. We live in a sea of ambient language, speech that surrounds and is also within us. Why not set it in motion to a music of its own, at least to honor what we experienced from ancient times to the present? For words are not rubble, but mosaic chips of salvific time and radiant naming. Fragments of intelligence, however fleeting, random signifiers that taken together become the shrine of a poem, a holy place.
Well, we might as well go off air right now, because those are all the things I want to know about you, and that you have set us up perfectly. And now, you've had such a significant writing life, and I thought I'd give everyone an encyclopedia glow of what you've done. So I'm going to name a book, and I hope you remember writing them, and you're going to give me a very neat description of that book. Okay, first, The Country Between Us.
The Country Between Us was a book that was reflective of experiences that I had in El Salvador in the time of the death squads, when the country was on the verge of civil war, and many other poems of my early and mid-20s, some of them tributes to Claribel Alegría. My translation work of her work led me to all of those experiences.
Well said. And the next is The Angel of History.
The Angel of History begins in Paris, and I'm hospitalized with a woman who had fled Nazi occupation, and she was a Jewish woman who escaped the Holocaust by this hiding. We spent a week together, and she spoke many languages with me and gave me in fragments her own story. And the book became a meditation on the whole of the 20th century.
You know all the answers. The next one is Blue Hour.
Blue Hour has a strange poem in it that's very long, and it's all of it is in alphabetical order, and I didn't know what it was when I started writing it, but as it came to a close, I realized that I might have been writing an imaginary death in which all of the moments of life flicker and pass before us in a kind of kaleidoscope of life. And I didn't know whether it was an individual life or a collective life. But Blue Hour is a quiet, meditative book, and I wrote it in my 40s.
In the Lateness of the World.
In the Lateness of the World was 17 years in the making, and it is my most recent collection. It wanders the world, but it also has a lot of the sea and boats and movement and bridges and travel and cities. And it's I think it's a soul in a journey around the world.
What You Have Heard Is True.
What You Have Heard Is True is a prose memoir. It felt a bit like writing poetry sometimes, but it is the story of an incredible man who came to visit me. He was a relative of Claribel Alegría, who heard about my work with her and invited me to come to El Salvador when it was on the verge of war. I didn't believe him that he would know in advance that war was coming, but I knew somehow I had to say yes to him.
that he wanted a poet and not a journalist.
Yes, he said when the war comes, we'll have many journalists. What we really need is a poet.
Every one of these books must be read because we are in the presence of genius today, and this does not happen every Wednesday. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Carolyn Forché is with me, and now we're going to hear a little bit of her present work, which is entitled what? I have to add it to the list. The new work.
I'm compiling a volume, my very first volume of new and selected poems called Otherwhere. New and selected poems, 1976 to 2026, and it is it's going to be published on the 50th anniversary of my first book, Gathering the Tribes.
And we are going to hear a poem. Here she is, Carolyn.
Well, this is a poem that I was asked to write for a volume of poems about birds in Washington State. And I was given the snowy plover to write about. So I like this poem because it lifts me a bit from the dire circumstances in which we find ourselves. The hurry birds. We called them hurry birds. The snowy plovers running along the sand in their congregation. Never close to the water, like the sanderlings, but just back and forth in their hunt for sandflies, mollusks, mealworms, these puffs of down or seafoam on twig legs, onyx-eyed, on the lower dunes, away from the water's edge, their nests in shallow cups of sand, left by the wind, or a child's pail, the footprint of a human, an animal track, or just an impression made by a stir of wind. Nests lined with bits of shell and pebbles, grasses and debris in invisible pockets of beach. Mm-hmm. They were here, just as we remember them, when we didn't know what they were called, or that their young sing while still in the egg. So much we didn't know as they hurried before us, that their nests open on open sand and never among the grasses meant to anchor dunes, grasses that are everywhere now, where the nests once were, or why they feigned a broken wing when we neared them. We know now. We know fire weather and sea rise, as they know the shadows of owls.
What a privilege to be here. Finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, winner of the Book Award for Human Rights in Latin America, Carolyn Forché. You've been visiting the Library of Congress before, but now you're here because you're chronicling. You have chronicled life's realities since the 1970s, the horrible things and the beautiful things. Okay, so what happenings can you not turn away from? For instance, Carolyn Forché sees this, she sees that, she does this, she's with this person, she travels here. What is the thing you cannot turn away then that you must write about? Of all the happenings in your life, what summons you to insist on making that permanent?
I've always wondered what's doing the choosing, because sometimes I have very incredible experiences that are very moving to me, and they never come to the page.
What's doing the choosing?
Right. So sometimes right away something will pour to the page, like the Colonel poem came to the page. It absolutely insisted on being there. But then I have other times when the poems stay in the universe without being ever committed to language. So I don't really know, because I've never been able to choose. I go to write without an idea of what's going to happen, and I wait and see what will happen, and I follow that.
So that brings me to the question that has I've always wondered, and I always wondered who to ask this to. So you have an experience, and then you try to transform it, and it becomes art in your hands, not in everyone's. And yet what are you trying to do? I mean, it does not depict reality. It distorts reality. It's not accurate. It's better than reality. talk about transformation and what you think happens to an ordinary event that cannot be the exact event when you change it to art. Is it the passion of the artist that makes it what it is?
Poetry and art for me is reflective of human consciousness, human perception, the human experience of the outer world. And so we do our best to be faithful, to be true to what it is we experience, but it passes through us. And in passing through us, it is changed.
Mm.
It's changed because the imagination is shapely, and it finds meaning and shape in that which has occurred to us, however randomly and however in the whirlwind of time and experience.
That says everything. Imagination is shapely. Did you ever say that before? Imagination is shapely. That answers my question, because then that is what transformation is, and that it comes through you, it's of you, and then it becomes actually your perception, whether it's accurate or not.
You see, this is why art is going to remain important for all of time, because it can't be made by artificial intelligence, which is not human and does not give us human consciousness in its shapeliness.
Thank you. Because someone was saying that voiceovers are in danger now because the robots are reading books, but they don't have what you're telling us. We'll call that soul. We'll call that Carolyn Forché, and now we're going to hear something from her. Tell us what you're going to read.
Well, I thought perhaps I should read, for many reasons, the Colonel poem.
If there's a generation that has not heard it, they must. That is what this is about. There may be people who have never heard it. We can hardly believe that.
It's possible that, of course. But I think younger generations will recognize it and acknowledge it, because these generations are already aware of what this poem has to say. They're living it in their own time. This came out of my experiences in El Salvador. The Colonel, what you have heard is true. I was in his house. His wife carried a tray of coffee and sugar. His daughter filed her nails. His son went out for the night. There were daily papers, pet dogs, a pistol on the cushion beside him. The moon swung bare on its black cord over the house. On the television was a cop show. It was in English. Broken bottles were embedded in the walls around the house to scoop the kneecaps from a man's legs or cut his hands to lace. On the windows, there were gratings like those in liquor stores. We had dinner, rack of lamb, good wine. A gold bell was on the table for calling the maid. The maid brought green mangoes, salt, a type of bread. I was asked how I enjoyed the country. There was a brief commercial in Spanish. His wife took everything away. There was some talk then of how difficult it had become to govern. The parrot said hello on the terrace. The colonel told it to shut up and pushed himself from the table. My friend said to me with his eyes, "Say nothing." The colonel returned with a sack used to bring groceries home. He spilled many human ears on the table. They were like dried peach halves. There is no other way to say this. Mm. He took one of them in his hands, shook it in our faces, dropped it into a water glass. It came alive there. "I am tired of fooling around," he said. "As for the rights of anyone, tell your people they can go fuck themselves." He swept the ears to the floor with his arm and held the last of his wine in the air. "Something for your poetry, no?" he said. Some of the ears on the floor caught this scrap of his voice. Some of the ears on the floor were pressed to the ground. San Salvador, May 1978.
The anthology Against Forgetting was praised by Nelson Mandela as itself a blow against tyranny, against injustice. In Stockholm, Carolyn Forché received the Adita and Ira Morris Harashima Award for Foundation for Peace and Culture for her human rights advocacy and the preservation of memory and culture. You know, you didn't set out in your life to create a historical record. You didn't wake up in the morning and say, I think when I grow up, I'm going to set a historical record for everybody, showing our time in poetry, our culture. But you did it. So the first thing you reflected on was not that. Can you hark back and remember what the beginning Carolyn reflected on before she became the witness that we all love?
My earliest aspirations were, I loved to write from an early age. I started when I was 9 years old. My mother knew that I wanted to do this, and she assigned me a poem one day during a blizzard. But I didn't think you could grow up to be a poet, so I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to do something that would save and help people.
And guess what?
That's what I wanted to do medicine. I think this came from at the age of 3. I saw a woman lifted into an ambulance from a street, and I thought, I want to lift people like that. Mm. You know, I want to do something like that.
I want to lift people. We'll just remember that right now, and we're going to hear another poem.
There's a new one here that is called Missing, which always haunted me because we had to search for bodies in El Salvador because people were being disappeared, taken off the street into vans and trucks that were unmarked by men who had masks on. And this one particular girl who was found, she haunted me for a long time. And I wrote this poem quite recently. It's called Missing. It was told to me this way by one of those who went searching for bodies in the morning. They came upon the dead girl lying among older corpses beside more bodies, to whom they were led by the sound of wings, the rising and falling of dark birds in the air above them, or to whom they were led by curious children on their way to the bus. Clusters of school kids were always a true sign. And the girl, this particular one, who seemed to be with child and about to give birth as she slept among the other corpses, undisturbed by the rats hurrying in and out of her skirt and up her empty sleeve. The arm was a little way from her, and her small gray hand a little further yet. The world where she was found hummed in the ears of the searchers. And the eyes of the dead were already flying through the clouds in the bellies of birds. She was not with child. They had done something to her to make it appear so.
Up her empty sleeve, the bellies of bird. How do you take the awful and make it lyrical? I guess with you it's just in your bloodstream, but to make something so beautiful. And my second thought is, how many years between the seeing and the writing? She's been haunting you.
Well, this one was 40 years because I couldn't write about her. I did write a long poem that she appears in, but it wasn't really the whole thing. And so I dreamt about her from time to time as in my life.
This is the whole thing. This is the whole thing. So it proves to us by this, and it demonstrates to us what a sacrifice it has been to be the writer who's the warrior. It shows us that perhaps it's even a beautiful form of PTSD, this poetry, because you have been dreaming of her for 40 years. And finally, do you think she's gone to rest because you wrote this poem? I think she's been visiting you and saying, just tell how it was. Tell about the empty sleeve. Now, any poet would have said, anything perhaps like this, but only you would say the empty sleeve. That's Caroline Porché.
I hope she's to rest. That's a beautiful thought,
but
if it's possible.
Why else would you have possibly written it 40 years later? And what? How did you process that at the time?
Well, at the time, we couldn't process because everyone in El Salvador, not only me, everyone, was terrified all the time.
And terrified all the
and
time.
And people were didn't have the peace to process anything. They were always looking over their shoulder and afraid. I think perhaps the way many people are now here, who are afraid because they are not here with the proper papers.
So you didn't have time, and 40 years later you do have the time. Although for those 40 years you've documented quite a bit of it, I think, and you've been noted for it because you've received the Academy of American Poets Fellowship in Poetry, the Guggenheim, the Lannan Foundation. You were one of the first poets to win the Wyndham Campbell Prize from the library at Yale. And you have had awards heaped on you. You have strangers love you who have never even met you. You are a celebrity. But you don't seem to know this. You just feel like Caroline, who keeps writing.
I think that is dangerous, you know, both to experience it, but to think about it or to know it or to dwell on it, it's dangerous to the human spirit.
The stone will grow cold in your hand.
That's right.
Let's have more poetry.
Well, I thought perhaps I could switch to the Museum of Stones, which is a poem.
The lateness of being.
I think rock collectors will appreciate something in this poem, but it was written for an Irish buster, a museum who played on the streets. And it's not just about stones, as people will recognize. He had built himself a museum of stones because he collected a little stone from the ground from everywhere he went, all over the world, and he labeled these stones and mounted them on a wall. And so one would say, pebble from beneath the Eiffel Tower, summer 1977, things like that. So I started making one of these museums, and of course I failed because I forgot to label them, and now they're just in a sack all together with no places associated with them. But here is the poem, Museum of Stones. These are your stones, assembled in matchbox and tin, collected from roadside, culvert, and viaduct, battlefield, threshing floor, basilica, abattoir. Stones, loosened by tanks in the streets, from a city whose earliest map was drawn in ink on linen. Schoolyard stones in the hand of a corpse. Pebble from Baudelaire's We. Stone of the mind within us, carried from one silence to another. Stone of cromlech and cairn, schist and shale, hornblende, agate, marble, millstones, choirs, ruins of choirs and shipyards, chalk, marl, mudstone from temples and tombs, stone from the silvery grass near the scaffold, stone from the tunnel lined with bones, lava of a city's entombment, stones chipped from lighthouse, cell wall, scriptorium, paving stones from the hands of those who rose against the army, stones where the bells had fallen, where the bridges were blown, those that had flown through windows, weighted petitions, feldspar, rose quartz, blue schist, gneiss, and chert. Fragments of an abbey at dusk, sandstone toe of a Buddha mortared at Bamiyan, stone from the hill of three crosses and a crypt, from a chimney where storks cried like human children, stones newly fallen from stars, a stillness of stones, a heart, altar and boundary stone, marker and vessel, first cast, load and hail, Bridgestones and others to pave and shut up with, stone apple, stone basil, stone berry, stone break, concretion of the body, as blind, as cold, as deaf, all earth a quarry, all life a labor, stone-faced, stone-drunk with hope, that this assemblage of rubble taken together would become a shrine or holy place, an ossuary immovable and sacred, like the stone that marked the path of the sun as it entered the human dawn.
I would call that a temple, but a temple doesn't move. And that thing moves. What did it take to write that poem? What kind of energy did you have to write that poem? What did you love enough to write that poem?
Well, it happened all at once, which sometimes poems don't do. When they flood to the page all at once, I trust them because they have a gushing forth from the spirit and the mouth and the language. And so this one became, the stones became a litany inside of it. And when you say a litany, you're praying. And when you're praying, you get energy. And I think that was how I would describe the experience of writing that
poem. I think you have said it just right. We can see it and we can feel it. Stone drunk with hope. That is my favorite stone. That is how you can take a list and make it a rainbow of words. You just can't teach that. We can't even teach that. That is so much from your being that I guess all we can tell people is to get in touch with their beings.
But if you read poets' poetry aloud, and you read it to yourself aloud, you begin to hear the music, and it becomes your own music.
Really good point. Larkin said something like that in an essay once, that he can't tell people how to write, but he can tell them just to read. And that's that. So Carolyn has been seen and heard. She's a chancellor of the Academy of American Poets, a member of the Academy of Arts and Sciences, a member of the Royal Academy of Literature in the UK, and is a distinguished university professor at Georgetown, which is what I wanted to talk about next. You have had a writing life as well as a teaching life, but you've always been teaching. And so now that you're a professor at Georgetown, what do you see as generational aspirations since the time you started teaching? These children are not the same ones that you started with. Are their dreams different? Are they writing more politically? What do you see as that generational change, if there is?
You know, the generational shifts happen, and they happen so softly and imperceptibly that sometimes it catches up with you all at once, and you realize that they have different history now, and that they were born later. But I've always spent my life with people who were between the ages of 18 and 22. I feel that I know this group, which this group is on the precipice of adulthood. They become adults during their time at the university, but they suffer as adults throughout that time. They have the same burdens, and every generation has them. This generation has I would say the weightiest burden of any I have taught. They understand the challenge. They understand what they've been born into. So what is theirs to do in the world, which is to save the biosphere.
Aww.
They know this, and they're beginning to understand they must also save democracy. They must save their republic. I just met with my graduating seniors the other day, and I was very heartened by the clarity of their vision of what their mission is on Earth.
You're graduating seniors. How many times have you said that, I wonder? But you've never entered an institution where you didn't change it. It was different when you left than when you came. So what innovation have you brought to Georgetown?
Well, I was very fortunate because I was able to establish a center at Georgetown, Lannan Center, and it is dedicated to the convergence of literary art, social justice, collective and political life. So it's literature come alive in the world, and we bring writers and poets from all over, and activists and journalists. And
That's a lot of work.
They meet with our students, and literature becomes a living being then for the students.
So one more thing, one more administrative detail that you take care of. I hope it's called the Carolyn Forché Center. It will be someday, I'll tell you. It better be.
It's the Lannan Center.
Semicolon. Another piece of writing, please.
All right. I think I'd like to... Is this my last one?
No.
Okay.
We're not finished with you.
I think because we are now having to... we must pay attention now to refugees all over the world. These are people who are fleeing danger. Humans don't uproot themselves and journey into a land unknown for no reason. They do so because they're in grave danger. And I would like to read a poem inspired by a confession that was made to me by a man who was from Homs in Syria. He was a man who was driving a cab in Milwaukee, and I got to know him. And one day as the snow was falling on the cab, he turned off the engine. And he said, "I will tell you how I got here if you promise someday to write about it." People say that a lot. And I said, "I can't promise, but I will try." So this became The Boatman. I was just lucky that whatever chooses the poems decided to allow this one to happen. "We were 31 souls," he said, "in the gray sick of sea, in a cold rubber boat, rising and falling in our filth. By morning, this didn't matter. No land was in sight. All were soaked to the bone, living and dead. We could still float, we said, from war to war. What lay behind us but ruins of stone, piled on ruins of stone. City called Mother of the Poor, surrounded by fields of cotton and millet. City of jewelers and cloakmakers, with the oldest church in Christendom and the sword of Allah. If anyone remains there now, they would be utterly alone. There is a hotel named for it in Rome, 200 meters from the Piazza di Spagna, where you can have breakfast under the portraits of film stars. There the staff cannot do enough for you. But I am talking nonsense again, as I have since that night. We fetched a child, not ours, from the sea, drifting, face down in a life vest, its eyes taken by fish or the birds above us. After that, Aleppo went up in smoke, and Raqqa came under a rain of leaflets warning everyone to go. Leave, yes, but go where? We lived through the Americans and Russians, through Americans again, many nights of death from the clouds, morning surprise to be waking from the sleep of death, still unburied and alive, with no safe place. Leave, yes, we'll obey the leaflets, but go where? To the sea to be eaten? To the shores of Europe to be caged? To camp misery and camp remain here? I ask you then, where? You tell me you are a poet. If so, our destination is the same. I find myself now the boatman, driving a taxi at the end of the world. I will see that you arrive safely, my friend. I will get you there.
No matter how difficult a thing is, no matter how hard it is, you write it anyway. But that is not the question. The question is the certainty. So you get something which is, that is very difficult to write, but you don't care. You're able to do the difficult. But it is the certainty with which you write it that I have to talk about. I don't know if anyone's noted it exactly like that. Someone is in charge of this horror. Someone is in control of this. We're okay. Someone knows what they're doing with this subject. Where does that come from?
Whoever's doing the choosing, maybe. I mean, it's some kind of thing that happens. I can't explain it. It's not me as a person in personality. It's a force. It's a force of language. It's a force of human
but
shaping. But
something about you somewhere made you very sure that you were entitled to do this. And I'm wondering if it started very early. I mean, you say you were the oldest of a group of eight children. I'm wondering if that take charge is even in here. I mean, there's psychological reasons as well as ephemeral ones, as well as intellectual ones that have made you who you are. And so when Camus says we write the same story over and over, although the subjects are varied, what do you think your story is that you're writing over and over? What is Carolyn's story? Is it to transform? Is it to take the horrible and make it beautiful? What is it? What is your story?
I wanted as a child to become a good soul. I was influenced by my mother and my grandmother. I was from Detroit. My father worked in a tool and die shop, and I didn't know I was going to be anything, but I knew that I used to go and sit under the stars at night and just let them be with me. And I would ask them questions, which of course they could not answer, but I would ask them about what I'm supposed to do in the world.
Now, what 8-year-old child is doing that?
Well, I think a lot of children wonder this.
I'm not under the stars. That is, see, I knew it. That's the answer. You've been star-kissed.
Okay, well,
You've been star-kissed.
I was pretty sure nothing was listening, but somehow everything fell into place later.
Well, we would like a final poem.
Well, I would like to read a very new poem, and it's really perhaps not so much a poem as a message that I would like to convey in this moment. It's called Report from a State of Emergency. In the early days, when most people said, "We don't yet know what will happen. It is better to wait and pretend to live as we have always lived. To stay inside the houses with their bright screens on the walls telling us everything is all right, even though the little screens we took to bed told us no and urged us to buy walkie-talkies, duct tape, tarpaulin, and water purifying straws, diapers for infants and dressing of wounds, batteries and canned food, urged us to write or call the elected representatives of the country we once knew while it was still possible to get through."
The voice of Carolyn Forché. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Cinebit Fund, the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family, and by friends of the program, Natalie Canivore and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Sandy Kinlock. I'm Grace Cavalieri.